Good morning, everyone. Thank you for that prayer, Chris. I want to speak today with the wisdom of God and not the wisdom of man. So pray for me in that. You can turn to Judges chapter 19. I want to try to cover Judges 19, 20, and 21. Judges 19, 20, and 21. This story is a crazy story. I mean, you don't even have to dramatize this story to make it interesting. This story is bizarre. And when I first started thinking about a message, I was going to look at multiple bizarre stories from the Bible and try to take lessons from them. But when I started getting into this story and listening to a pastor teach on this story, it's like there's enough content here. I don't even have to go to any other story. This story is big, and there's lots to take from it. So we'll probably just, and I think I'll have to hurry to even get through it. So I don't want to cut into our afternoon schedule here. So we're just going to get right in. The kickoff verse is Judges 21:25, the last verse in the book of Judges. Judges 21:25. It says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And that explains a lot. That explains why this story of 19 to 21 happened, Judges 19 to 21. It explains the depravity of this story, the depravity of man, and how low man can go without God, when everybody does that which is right in their own eyes. We as humans have the capability of going this low. If it were not for God, if it were not for laws of the land, if it were not for, I was just talking with Marvin earlier about this, and you know, we have culture that kind of props us up. We have laws of the land that kind of dictate what we can or can't do. But we have to recognize the depravity in our own hearts. Without all that, we can go this low. And this was Israel. This was Israel's special called out people that went this low. Without God, we can go this low. We need to recognize that in our own hearts and start there. We can point all the fingers we want to and say, these Israelites and anybody else want to point out. But we must first fix our own hearts before we want to take a speck out of somebody else's eye. We've got a big log on our own. So let's get right into it. Chapter 19. We're just going to breeze through this chapter, and then 20 and 21 has most of the content we want to look at. Judges 19. "It came to pass in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. But his concubine played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah." So she went back home, went back to dad, apparently. "Then her husband rose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back, having his servant and a couple donkeys with him. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the father of the young woman saw him, he was glad to meet him. Now his father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there." So it seemed like he had a good relationship with his father-in-law. He was welcomed in, and they ate and drank together. Very cultural for the Middle East. That's what they do. And he stayed for days and days, and the father-in-law kept pressing him. "Then it came on the fourth day," verse 5, "they arose early in the morning, and he stood to depart, but the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, 'Refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward go your way.' So they sat down, the two of them ate and drank together. Then the young woman's father said to the man, 'Please be content to stay all night, and let your heart be merry.' When the man stood to depart, his father-in-law urged him, so he lodged there again. Then he rose early in the morning on the fifth day to depart, but the young woman's father said, 'Please refresh your heart.' So they delayed until the afternoon, and both of them ate. And when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the young woman's father, said to him, 'Look, the day is now drawing toward evening. Please, spend the night. See, the day is coming to an end. Lodge here, then that your heart may be merry. Tomorrow, go your way early so that you may go home.'" This is not uncultural. This is very cultural for the land. This is not unusual that they would say, "Yeah, stay, stay, stay. Keep pressing, keep pressing." Sometimes you have to say no a couple of times before you're going to be, before you can move, get on your way. However, the man was not willing to spend the night, so he rose and departed and came opposite Jabez, that is Jerusalem, And I was trying to place this. I think this must have happened before David had taken the city of the Jebusite city, which is today Jerusalem. So this was in the time of the judges before King David. With him were the two saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. They were near Jabez, and the day was far spent, and the servant said to his master, "Come, please, let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and lodge in it." But his master said to him, "We will not turn aside here in a city of foreigners, who are not of the children of Israel. We will go on to Gibeah." Gibeah was just a little bit north. So he said to his servant, "Come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night in Gibeah or in Ramah." And verse 14, they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. So it was a Benjaminite city. They turned aside there to go into lodge in Gibeah, and when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Just then an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who also was from the mountains of Ephraim. He was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. When he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" So he said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah. Now I am going to the house of the Lord." And I don't know, but that may have been referring to Shiloh. If he was going to Shiloh, where I believe the tabernacle may have been, if I have my facts straight. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. But I believe Shiloh was north of there. But there is no one who will take me into his house, although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant, and for the young man who is with your servant. There is no lack of anything. And the old man said, "Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square." So he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. As they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally." But the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage." Now this also is cultural. From what I understand, if you, and I think it's true that I have heard this said personally, if you go into the house of a local there, they are duty bound by their culture, their way of doing things. They are duty bound to protect you. And if someone comes in against you, they will protect you. You are their guest under their roof. They will protect you. And I think in some cases, maybe all, I shouldn't say all, but I think in many cases, they would even protect you to the death. They would kill the intruder who's trying to hurt you. So this is very cultural. This is not unnormal. "Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. Look, here's my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now. Humble them and do with them as you please. But to this man, do not do such a vile thing." But the men would not heed him. So the man took his concubine and brought her out to them. They knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. When her master rose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go to his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up and let us be going." But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went his place. When he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of his concubine, and divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And so it was that all who saw it said, No such deed has been done or seen from the day the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up." This got their attention. Israel was depraved. Israel was in a bad situation. This event happened that kind of sparked a series of terrible events. But remember, it was all related to the situation of Israel. The heart of Israel was terrible. This event was terrible, but it revealed problems in the heart of Israel. And they said, this thing blew it up. Like, "We have never seen such a thing." He's like, "We've never seen anything like this in our lives before." But it was an indication of the situation of Israel, the heart of Israel. They said, "Consider it, confer, and speak up." It got their attention. When this woman was divided and spread out through all Israel, it got their attention. I think it's probably what he wanted, this Levite. Remember, the Levite was part of the tribe that was set aside for special service to God. maybe not all priests, but at least serving at the tabernacle. I don't have all those details at the tip of my head. Anyway, the Levite came from there. So he got the attention of Israel. They listened. They realized something was bad, wrong. Something happened. And this sets the context for what happened in 20 and 21. This sets the story. It showcases the depravity of Israel, and it got the attention of Israel. They were so appalled by this thing. Somehow the word got out. They all came together and decided to meet at Mizpah. I don't know where Mizpah was exactly, but they all came there. Except one group of people. Let's keep reading. So all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, as well as from the land of Gilead. Now Gilead was east of Jordan. Most of Israel was on the west side of Jordan, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. There was a few people, a couple groups maybe, that lived over on the east side of Jordan, across the Jordan. That was Gilead. And there was one group of people, Jabesh Gilead, that did not come to this meeting. That's important detail because later it comes up. And the congregation gathered together as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. So they were united. They were zealous. This was an outrageous deed. They were zealous. They were ready to take things in their own hands. Verse 2, the leaders of all the people, all the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. Now remember, this is Benjamin. This is a tribe of Israel. So this is Israel against their own people. This is civil war that's about to happen. This is their brothers. This is not the pagans. They were supposed to be fighting the pagans. Here they're fighting their own people. Let's keep reading. In the middle of verse 3. The children of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this wicked deed happen?" So the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, "My concubine and I went into Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, to spend the night. And the men of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me, but instead they ravished my concubine so that she died. So I took hold of my concubine, cut her in pieces, and sent her throughout all the territory of the inheritance of Israel, because they committed lewdness and outrage in Israel. Look, all of you are children of Israel. Give your advice and counsel here and now." So they all came together, and the Levite was there. He told them what happened. However, back to the original problem. Where was the original problem here? Israel was the original problem. They were depraved. This Benjamite group of people, yes, they did a horrible, horrible thing. This group of men that did this were very horrible. But you know how we do so often when we have terrible problems within ourselves? You know how we quickly start blaming? We start poking fingers? But they, we highlight things that look so bad on one event, and we kind of just smooth over the whole problem. I smooth over my heart because I want to point out and pick at your problem. That's my heart. That's the heart of man. That's what we do. So Israel, they were zealous. They had righteous indignation about this thing. They were angry that this thing had happened. Rightly so. But they were ignoring the bigger problem. They were depraved. They were doing what was right in their own eyes because there was no king. There was nobody that was leading them, at least not in a large degree. So they were zealous against this evil, but they were ignoring a bigger problem. Also, this Levite. Now, this might be extrapolating a little bit, but think about this. He said, this Levite said, the men of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me, but instead they ravished my concubine so that she died. That sounds pretty noble. It's like, they were going to come kill me, but then instead they took my concubine. He never mentioned, at least it's not recorded here. We don't know what all he said. But if we're going to take it exactly like it's written, he didn't say anything about the fact that he pushed her out the door and gave it to them. I mean, women were treated like property. It was not good. He gave up his concubine to them and let them do what they wanted with her. I mean, is he guilty or isn't he? And here he's blaming them. They're going to kill me, but then they took... He smoothed over the story. Again, I'm kind of putting in some details here. I was influenced by something I was listening to. But he smoothed over his own actions and made it look good for himself when he was talking to all Israel. They were going to kill me, but then they took my concubine. But I actually pushed her out the door. No, he never said that. But he did. He pushed her out the door. He forced her to go. And the man of the house, the old man, was going to give up his virgin daughter as well. But it doesn't say that actually happened. Apparently, this group of men were satisfied with just the concubine. I don't know. Earlier, he said, the old man said, take my virgin daughter and this guy's concubine. But apparently, only the concubine was forced out. That's as I take it. If I'm reading something wrong, you can correct me. But anyway, this Levite forced his concubine to go out. He didn't say anything about that. Not as it's recorded. Okay? Let's keep moving. It is our fallen nature to do this. We as humans do this. We look at the wrongs of others, cover up our own wrong, and highlight the wrongs of them and say, look at him, look what he did. Jesus looked at this issue when he was talking with the religious rulers or Pharisees or whoever they were that brought the woman caught in adultery. You remember that story? They brought the woman caught in adultery to Jesus and said, look at this woman, look what she did. She was caught in the act of adultery. So what did Jesus do? Okay, throw stones at her. Go ahead. No. Jesus said, after writing on the ground for a while, I really wonder what he was writing, but after he was writing on the ground for a while, he raised up and he said, where can I find my notes? He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first. So he didn't, and then he said to the woman, he said, go and sin no more. He didn't ignore her sin. That's not what we're talking about. But he laid the axe at the root of the tree. He put the problem right where it was. And in this story, what I'm trying to bring out is Israel was the problem. It was not just these Benjaminites. Yeah, they had a problem, but Israel was the bigger problem. They all had a problem. There was problems throughout Israel. So this is how humans do. This is what I am capable of if I go without God. If I let God out of my life, this is what I am capable of stooping to, where I just whitewash myself and go after somebody else. We play the blame game. That's what we do as humans, if without the Spirit of God ruling in our hearts. So this is what they were doing. And verse 8. Let's go to verse 8. And the Levite said, look, all of you are children of Israel. In verse 7, he says, give your advice and counsel here and now. Verse 8. So all the people rose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, 100 out of every 1,000, and 1,000 out of every 10,000 to make provisions for the people, that when they come to Gibeah and Benjamin, they may repay all the vileness that they have done in Israel. So all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united together as one man. They were zealous. They had righteous indignation. And we might say rightly so. Then the tribes of Israel sent men throughout all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what is this wickedness that has occurred among you? Now therefore, deliver up the men, the perverted men who are in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. So, there's always two sides, or three sides, or four sides of any story. In this case, they did some things wrong, and they did some things right. I would like to say they did something right here, the men of Israel, against Benjamin. They did say, give up those evil men. Give those men up, that we may purge unrighteousness from Israel. So the rest of the story is horrible, but I will say they gave Benjamin a chance. They did. They said, give up the evil men that have done this act. They gave them a chance. But the children of Benjamin would not listen. And where are we at again? Verse 13. The children of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. They were arrogant. They were proud. They knew this evil had happened within their tribe, and they weren't willing to give it up. They weren't willing to say, yep, here they are, take them, do with them what you need. And the law of Moses, I don't know exactly what would have had to happen, but likely according to the law of Moses, these fellows would have had to die, possibly their families, possibly their beasts. I don't know. I don't know how far it went. What I don't think was required by the law, I don't think it would have been required for Israel to nearly annihilate them, to nearly cause them to go in extinction. But as we will see, that's what Israel did. So I will say Israel did right by saying, give up those evil men. But when that didn't happen, they took out their fury on Benjamin and nearly wiped them out. And I don't think that was of God. We don't see God anywhere commanding them to do that, to that extent. But they were talking to God eventually. Where should we start again? Verse 14. Instead, the children of Benjamin gathered together from the cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel. And from their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men. Among all this people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. So they had 26,000 men plus 700 sharpshooters, these Benjaminites. They had these sharpshooters. And I would like to think that they were arrogant. We know they were arrogant because they weren't going to give up this evil men from their midst. And by the way, Paul talked about that type of arrogancy in the New Testament when he spoke to the church of 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians, I'll pull it up here. 1 Corinthians 5, he talks to the Corinthian church. He said in, I think, verse 1, it is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you and of a kind that is not tolerated even among pagans, for a man has his father's wife. And you are arrogant. Ought you not rather to mourn? Let him who has done this be removed from among you. So Paul was addressing the sin in Corinthian church. At the same time, he was addressing the Corinthian church for their arrogancy, because they didn't deal with this sin. So God hates arrogancy. God hates that. In the Corinthian church, they weren't willing to deal with it. At least in the story, Israel was attempting to do something about it. The arrogancy in this case is somewhat, we're focusing on the Benjaminites. They were arrogant because they didn't want to give up their sin. They were kind of like the Corinthian church. There was evil among them and they weren't giving it up. And they were depending on their might, their physical strength, their own physical strength. 26,000 men and 700 sharpshooters. We might call them snipers today. They could be that accurate. But they were coming up against, what does it say? 400,000 men of Israel. Verse 17. Now besides Benjamin, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All of these were men of war. So, comparing, it might be like taking a BB gun against F-16 fighters or a 22 or something. Isn't that arrogant? Seriously? That's arrogant. But they were going to do this. They thought they were going to fight Israel. But Israel, they weren't sitting very well themselves in relation to God. They did inquire of God here. I want you to notice the change of tone in Israel as this story develops. We're going to read 19 to 28. So, again, Benjamin had 26,000 people plus 700 sharpshooters. Israel had 400,000 people. And it should have been a cinch. The war should have been over in the first couple hours. But God was going to do something here. God was going to teach Israel something and Benjamin something in one shot. He was going to kill two birds with one stone. Because, remember, Israel was a nation that had forgotten God. They were a nation that was doing what was right in their own eyes. There was no king in those days. So, in verse 18, the children of Israel arose and went up to the house of God, apparently to Shiloh, and they said, which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin? So they were inquiring of God. Let's give them that. They were going to go ask God. But they didn't say, Lord, what shall we do? Should we go? What do you want us to do? Should we go? Should we stay? They simply said, which of us shall go up first? They had their minds made up. They were going to go. But they asked God, which one should go first? And the Lord answered them. Sometimes the Lord will answer us, even when we are in the wrong. He will answer us, and He will tell us what to do, but He has some training and discipline in mind. In this case, I think that's what happened. The Lord said, Judah first. So the children of Israel rose up in the morning and camped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin, and the men of Israel put themselves in battle array to fight against them at Gibeah. Then the children of Benjamin came out of Gibeah, and on that day cut down to the ground 22,000 men of the Israelites. And the people, that is, the men of Israel, encouraged themselves, and again formed the battle line at the place where they had put themselves in array on the first day. Then the children of Israel went up and wept. Now remember the tone, the change of tone as this story progresses. They went up before the Lord until evening and asked counsel of the Lord, saying, shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? Now I was calling him my brother. The Lord said, go up against him. All right? But He didn't say you're going to win. The Lord said, go up against him. So the children of Israel approached the children of Benjamin on the second day, and Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah on the second day and cut down to the ground 18,000 more of the children of Israel. All these drew the sword. So if my math is correct, that's 40,000 people that were killed in 2 days against only 26,000 people. And Israel had 400,000. I don't know if all the 400,000 went out. It's a little vague. But Judah went first. Does that mean only Judah went first and the rest came behind? I don't quite know. But there was 400,000 against 26,000 plus 700 sharpshooters. But the small group killed 40,000 people in the first day, first 2 days. All right, verse 26. Then all the children of Israel, that is, all the people, went up and came to the house of God and wept. They went back to the house of God, sat there. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening. And they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. So the children of Israel inquired of the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. So apparently a grandson of Aaron was there working with the at the tabernacle. At Shiloh, I believe. And he seemed to be a man of God. But it just mentions that. He stood before the Ark of the Covenant in those days. And moving on, saying, Israel was saying, shall I yet go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. So now, finally, God has given them assurance of victory. He didn't give them assurance of victory the first 2 days. He said, go up, but He didn't give them assurance of victory. And Israel, probably going in their own strength and trusting in their own numbers, they went up, thinking, we're going to do this, no problem. God said, go up. But God didn't promise them assurance of victory. Thinking back, when Israel was coming into Canaan, how many times did God assure them of victory? I don't have a number in mind. But when God said, you're going to win, it was like, no big deal. They just had to do what God commanded, and they won. In this case, God said, go up, but He didn't say, I'm going to give you a victory. So, the change in their tone is what I want to highlight here. They first said, who shall go up first? We're going to do this. Then they sat down for a bit. After they lost, they encouraged themselves, and they, it's okay, we got this. But they did sit down, and verse 23, I think, is what I'm looking for. Yeah. The children of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening and asked counsel of the Lord, shall I go up? Shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? So this time they're asking, at least. They're saying, shall I go against my brother Benjamin? So they recognize this was their brother. Their tone is changing. They're not quite so zealously angry. They had been tempered just a little bit. Then God said, go up again, and they lost again the second day. Now this really is getting their attention. Now they're changing their tone a lot. Which verse do I want to see? Verse 26. Yeah, verse 26. Then all the children of Israel, that is, all the people, went up and came to the house of God and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day. Now they're fasting. And they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. I'm not sure that they had done burnt offerings the first time. But anyway, this time they are. And burnt offerings is an indication of sacrificing for my sin. So they're being really tempered now. They're realizing that, oh, what's wrong here? Because maybe, I don't know if they remembered it, but when they went against Ai years and years ago, when they went against Ai, they did not win at Ai because of sin in the camp. Were they thinking about this when they went up against Benjamin and lost? Were they thinking, perhaps there is sin in my camp? Hopefully. What I think God was doing, one thing God was doing, was showing Israel, look, you've got a problem. You've got a problem. Yes, Benjamin has a problem, but you have a problem. And he showed them both in that one war. He showed both Benjamin and Israel, you guys got a problem. The root of the problem is in all Israel, not just Benjamin. And so he tempered them. He crushed them before he gave them victory. He made them lose a lot before he gave them victory. But finally, when they came to God in that tone, with that attitude of humility, and I don't think they were totally all right with God yet because of the way the story unfolds after this. Yeah, they were still dependent on their own man's wisdom. But, you know, God has a lot of time in bringing us to what he wants us to be. He'll take years, if it's necessary, to bring us to what he wants us to be. Because the rest of the story indicates still that Israel's heart was not quite right yet. So, but at least they're coming. At least they're asking God, shall I go or shall I cease? And God said, go. And this time you will be successful. Verse 29. Then Israel set men in ambush all around Gibeah. We're running out of time. Anyway, they set themselves in ambush, and they used this ambush method where Israel had a group of men that went out in front and attracted the Benjaminites out of their city, and they came and chased after them, and it said they gave ground to the Benjaminites, knowing they were trusting in the main ambush. So the main ambush was hidden over here, and when the men of Gibeah came out, the ambush came in, went in and burned the city, and they had an agreed sign. When you see the smoke rise out of the city, then you can turn. And here then they caught the Benjaminites, and they slaughtered them to the death. They overtook them, they chased them, and I think it says they killed 25,000 in verse 46. So all who fell of Benjamin that day were 25,000 men who drew the sword. All these were men of valor. So I'd have to go through and look at the math, but 25,000 out of 26,000 is 100, there's 1,000 left. But then there were 600. Only 600 that escaped and fled to the Rock of Rimmon, verse 47. 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the Rock of Rimmon, and they stayed at the Rock of Rimmon for 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back against the children of Benjamin and struck them down with the edge of the sword. From every city, men and beast, all who were found, they also set fire to all the cities they came to. They ravished Benjamin. They were angry, and they were going to set the record straight. They were going to purge the men of Benjamin from evil. But God had some purging to do in Israel's heart before this happened. This should cause me to be introspective. What about me? When I'm looking at everybody else and thinking everybody else is wrong, you've got problems. There's a pretty good indication that there's a big problem right here. Pride is so slippery. It slips in so easily. And I'm very vulnerable to this. Very vulnerable to this. So God help me. Let's go to Judges 21 and continue on. We're going to have to just skip over details here. But another important point is the oaths. When they were gathered at Mizpah, there were two oaths that they had made. Israel said, whoever does not come to Gibeah, to Mizpah, in the first meeting, flashback to that meeting at Mizpah, when all the men of Israel rose up and came to Mizpah to talk about the situation of the Benjaminite. They said, whoever doesn't come to Mizpah is going to die. So everybody must come. They also said, whoever gives your daughters in marriage to Benjamin, they said you may not do it, and I'm assuming the cost of it would be death, but they said we will not give our daughters in marriage to Benjamin. So here's the problem. They made these vows, and they couldn't go back on vows. The Bible is very clear that if you're going to vow, you better pay. It said it's better to not vow than to vow and not pay. So if you're going to make a vow, better pay, but make vows carefully. That's what I would like to highlight. Make vows very carefully, very prayerfully and thoughtfully, because if you're going to make a vow, you better keep it. The Bible is clear on that. Unless it's a vow of sin, of course, God, you can come before God in repentance and repent of a vow of sin. But they made these two vows and they got themselves in a big hang-up because of this. So, where do we go here? 21. I'm going to have to just skip. They had a messy situation. They really did. They had these Benjaminites that needed to be purged, but they had these vows that kept them from doing everything that they could. They had these 600 men that were gone, and now they're weeping before the Lord. Why did you let this happen? Why did you let this happen? Because not what they were changing their tone. They realized now a tribe of Israel, Benjamin, was about to be annihilated. This tribe of Benjamin could have been wiped out because all they had left was 600 men. They killed everybody, apparently. It sounds like they killed everybody. And yet they couldn't give their daughters in marriage to these 600 men. So these 600 men of Benjamin were going to die out when they got old, and Benjamin would be wiped out. And they wept before the Lord. Let's look at verse 3 of 21. And said, O Lord God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel that today there should be one tribe missing in Israel? I wonder what God thought at that point. Couldn't he have looked down and said, look at your bloodstained sword. You still got blood in your swords. Now you're asking me why this happened? It's like you did this to yourself. Now you're coming to me and asking why this happened. Sometimes we wonder, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, look at your own heart. Look at my own heart. We make decisions and we make choices that bring this kind of stuff upon us. Israel had just, they were about to lose a tribe of Benjamin, and they were asking God why this happened. And perhaps they're still holding their bloodstained swords. It's like, people, wake up. You guys are guilty. It doesn't say that, but that's the implication that we could take out of there. They rose the next morning and offered peace offerings and burnt offerings. And then they had this bright idea. They got this problem. They got to fix. Now back to, I don't think that God was completely done with teaching them yet, because they were still thinking in the ways of man. They were still thinking with the wisdom of man because of how they handled this situation. They couldn't give their daughters to Benjamin so they wouldn't be wiped out. And they had this vow that said, whoever doesn't come to Mizpah must be destroyed. You will die. So somebody came up with a bright idea and said, is there anybody here? Is anybody that didn't come to Mizpah? And they counted among themselves and they realized that Jabesh Gilead hadn't come. Said, oh, here we go. All right, let's come up with we got this bright idea. Let's go and kill them so we can have their women for these Benjaminites. So we're going to solve killing by more killing. Okay? That's the wisdom of man. That's awesome. I mean, great. Really? This is the way man can, this is the heart of man when they are without God. We come up with man-made ways of doing things to resolve the mess that we just created. I mean, what if they would have just fallen down before God at the beginning and said, Lord, we messed up. How can you fix this? We repent. How can you fix this issue with Benjamin? I think God would have had a beautiful way of solving this. Maybe the Benjaminites would have given up their men right at the beginning. If Israel's heart would have been right, but Israel's heart was not right. And they had to fight and they lost people. And then they came up with man-made ways of spinning some resolution. And this is what it was. Let's go kill some more of our brothers so we can take their girls and give them to these poor 600 men out there hanging out on the Rock of Ramon. So they did. That's a great idea. Let's go kill some more people. Take their young women. So they went, killed a bunch of people there, most everybody, I think, except these 400 young women who were not married. Took them, then verse 13, Verse 13 and 21, then the whole congregation sent word to the rock of, to the children of Benjamin who were at the rock of Ramon and announced peace to them. So they gave them, they said, this, we're coming in peace and we're coming and we're giving you these women. So Benjamin came back at that time and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh Gilead, and yet they had not found enough for them. So they had 600 men, 400 women. Got a problem. 600 minus 400 is 200. What are we going to do? Now, still 200 men. I mean, they should have been looking to God and asking what they should do. But they took things in their own hands yet further. And I don't know what God would have done if they would have been truly asking him. And I'm not reading the details very closely here, but verse 15, the people grieved for Benjamin. So now they're actually grieving for Benjamin, whereas before they were angry and ready to wipe them out. Now, in verse 15, they grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made a void in the tribe of Israel. Really? Did the Lord do that? I think Israel did that. But, you know, an interesting verse that was pointed out to me, Proverbs 19, verse 3. I'm all over my notes. I'm not following very closely, but Proverbs 19:3 says something like this. When I can't quote it. When come to ruin, then when a man comes to ruin, then his heart rages against the Lord. It's in my notes here somewhere. I just can't find it. Anyway, so this is what happens when a man's heart is not after God. We come to ruin, and then we yell at God and say, why'd you let this happen? This can be the heart of man. This is how we can come to if we're not careful. So they said there must be inheritance. So what we're going to do, here's a bright idea. This is their bright idea to fix this. They said, what we're going to do, since we can't give our girls in marriage to these 200 men, we're going to just let them kidnap some girls. There's this yearly feast, they said. There's this yearly feast in verse 19. Feast of the Lord in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up to Bethel, from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebanon. They told these 200 remaining Benjaminites, go up to this yearly feast of the Lord and just lie in wait in the bushes somewhere. And when these girls come out to dance because of the feast, this annual feast of the Lord, go out and snatch them, kidnap them, take them away. Now, how is this for a feast of the Lord? Really? I mean, this is supposed to be a sacred event or a festival. And this was Israel's resolution to getting these guys their wives. So go up there, up to the feast of the Lord and kidnap some women, take them back home. I mean, humanly speaking, it was a way out. It was. But it was messed up. I mean, really, this was messed up. It shows you how bad Israel was at this point. And these were, I think, elders of Israel that were given these instructions. Somewhere talked about the elders of Israel. So that's what they did. They went up there, they got them their wives, kidnapped them, and then they said, it shall be, verse 22, it shall be when their fathers or their brothers come for us to complain, we will say to them, be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in war, for it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath. So they made this oath that we can't give them, and so if you don't let them have these women by kidnapping, then you're guilty of the oath. Or something like that. It's really strange rationale. But they, in other words, they tried to throw the guilt back on these men, that these fathers and brothers that were concerned about their daughters and sisters getting kidnapped. I mean, okay, those of you who are fathers, how would you feel about somebody coming to kidnap you, even if it's of your own family? Your cousins come and kidnap your daughters and take them off for wife. How would you feel? Would you just sit there and be quiet? It's okay, it's okay.
I don't want to say it right now.
You got it, brother. Oh, I mean, this is crazy. But they said, no, we'll tell them just to be okay. And if you don't, you're guilty because of this oath. This is how messed up Israel was. It is crazy. But again, we are so quick to point out the evil of others and just smooth over our own hearts. That's what I really want to point out. Because these people were made of the same flesh and blood that you and I are. We happen to be born into a different culture that doesn't allow these things, thankfully. But what I'm saying is the heart of man is the same. We have the same red blood, the same fallen nature. We can go this low, and let's not be arrogant and think that we're somehow better than these people. Basically, the last verse sums it up. Again, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's kind of like an aha moment. It's like, oh, yeah. You know, when somebody's telling a story and they end up with a single detail, it's like, oh, that explains it. That's what this is. And the writer kind of threw that in there at the end and explained everything. And the whole book of Judges is probably included in that. There's so much mess in Israel during the whole book of Judges. Proverbs 3, verse 6, in all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. If we want to resort to our own human reasoning, try to figure the things out on our own, we can do that, but the way is going to be hard, and we're going to have a bunch of knocks and bumps until God can bring us around. But if we simply acknowledge him in all of our ways, he'll direct us, and it will be well. So Israel should have done that. So, sorry I had to rush so bad, but I think I better quit now. Thank you.